Well, you described two different sets of things last class. You described the Buddha going into Ganden, emanating, going into his mother's womb. And then you described the physical characteristics to obtain Ogmen, etc. Which of those things is the one that Maitreya did to get into, to create his paradise? It wasn't clear to me which was Maitreya's activity and which was some other general description.
As a lot of things in Buddhism, it's a general pattern of all Buddhas.
So what was one referring to versus the other one referring to? It wasn't clear how the two were separate from each other and distinct.
People ask me, why did you pick Maitreya? Because Maitreya, it mixed up some people because they knew that in one of the classes we had, we were talking about the debate about whether Maitreya is a Buddha already or not. And the end of that debate is that you're not supposed to mix up Tantra and Sutra.
Right.
In Sutra, Maitreya is the coming Buddha. He's not a Buddha yet. So that's a description of how he will become a Buddha. But it's always the same pattern. You leave your chukku in Ganden, you go to Ogmen, you actualize your Dharma body, you go back into the chukku, and then you pretend to act out the 12 deeds on earth. And it's the same for every Buddha family. That seems to be a pattern.
That's how you get to paradise. What was the other set of descriptions, 1 through 7? What was that then? The directly perceive the totality of noble things, reach the final limit.
Those are simultaneous. I mean, those are describing the same thing.
So,
they're from different sections of the Abhisamayakara.
So
one is describing, the outer process that he goes through. The other is describing the inner events that happen. All of those happen at the moment he reaches Ogmen and actualizes his Dharma body. They're actually tied to that one step.
So which was the answer to the homework question?
if you mixed it up, I don't mind, it doesn't matter. Either one. What happened was I wrote the homework and then I found the second reference. and I thought you'd like to know both. I think they're both useful to understand how these are come to do this.
Last question I have is about how seeing emptiness or how studying the Diamond Cutter Sutra purifies negative karma. I understand how knowing about emptiness prevents you from creating more negative karma.
That's mainly it.
But how does it cause past karma to ripen now and create suffering now? I don't understand that.
What's the process by which the seed is triggered early or something like that?
Why when you study the sutra do you suffer intensely now or soon or whatever?
I just tell you what I think because I don't know. But I think it's that obviously the main thing that would purify you of a bad deed is to strictly never do it again. And you know that from your own intuition. If you have a personal bad habit, and like if you're an alcoholic or something like that, and you overcame it, you know how having stopped drinking somehow purifies all the wrong you did while you were drinking. There's some kind of relationship between that.
So what I don't understand is why then it isn't destroyed versus it ripens as suffering, for example.
It was created by a bad thing, so it has to have a bad result.
Does that mean you can't destroy karma without experiencing some bad result?
In fact, they don't even say you destroy it. Ultimately, when it stops, it's because you remove the conditions which are required for it to mature. I think the process is like this. You're trying to remove every single bad karma you ever collected would be like picking dandelions. When you pick one and the seeds fall off, and, it'd be almost impossible. But you create conditions which are not conducive to its ripening.
So perhaps in understanding emptiness, you do eliminate some from ripening completely, and others are just partially?
I don't know. I don't. If I were in a debate, I'd say, no, you can't. They have to ripen. But they could ripen less.
I thought you completely purified karma, so it didn't ripen.
I don't think so. It's very interesting. Seeing emptiness mainly prevents you from doing it again. That's why there's a path of habituation. That's why there's a fourth path. If just seeing emptiness directly destroyed all your karma, there wouldn't be any path of habituation. You wouldn't have to apply what happened in that 5 or 10 minutes of experience to the rest of your life or something. There's only two mental afflictions that are destroyed by the path of seeing, and that's doubt and the intellectual belief in self-existence. And then all the other ones are still meta.
I thought when we studied karma, you said that when you damage the seeds to the extent that they aren't able to ripen, the causes and conditions aren't there.
Then I'd say you can do that, and you can reach a point like that. But your elementary understanding of emptiness created by studying the diamond cutter is only enough to make it regular.
Okay.
Did you say how it represents?
Yeah. What's the process?
I was going to let it go.
I don't know. There's nothing in the scripture where they obviously explain that.
It clearly says it ripens.
It obviously says it many times.
And
that it ripens quicker and less. You know, how or why?
But is it ripening less because it's less powerfully simply because it doesn't accumulate the same amount of force because it's ripening sooner?
I don't get that feeling. I don't get that feeling.
Well, that's going to be hard in it, no?
I don't think so. Because if you died today with that on your conscience, it would still send you to the hell. You see what I mean?
Can you use the analogy of a seed? If you put a seed in some sort of weird mixture of soil, you don't get a full tree, but you get some like weird mutant kind of living thing.
You get a stunted tree.
Yeah, right.
But isn't it based on the quality of the deed?
I don't know. I can't say exactly, but I think it has to do with... I'll ask Rupert to say, first of all. And then secondly, I would say it has to do with the fact that you do the one of the four forces which is most powerful, really, which is that you just stop doing the thing. And I think that has effect on the karmic seeds of having done it in the past. I believe the act of restraining yourself in the future is the main force that prevents the karma from ripening fully. Maybe it means that continuing to water that seed with the same water that it was planted with, you know what I mean? Makes it... I mean, stopping the habit is the most powerful thing for stopping the power of the karma, I think.
And
I believe that.
And it may be stopping the habit also has the effect of causing all those similar seeds to assert themselves.
Maybe. But I can't say I've seen anything like that in scripture. I haven't seen it go beyond that.
But the imprint won't be as strong. The longer it goes on, the longer you continue to do
that.
It, or the longer you live continuing to do it.
Yeah.
Or the more lifetimes you go through.
It'll be deeper. I don't know. I haven't seen that explained. There is debates about it in the Tengger, which probably there might be some more information there. I can show it to you. Quick,
just not satisfactory response.
No, I know. I haven't seen anything that explains. I mean, I'll state the question again. What's the process which makes the karma ripen earlier? I haven't seen anything that explains why. I've only seen statements that it does. And I've seen arguments about why some people think it couldn't. You know, but if the Diamond Cutter Sutra states it. I don't know. I can't say why. I don't think I've seen. You know, we did pretty well with karma and explaining how it replicates, how it's carried in your mind stream. There's nothing in those scriptures that I remember that explains why it should ripen anywhere. It is the force, it is the function of the four forces to make it ripen earlier, but I don't know.
Can you ask next time you go
back? I'll ask
next
time,
And the source? What's the source of that four purpose?
Yeah, I don't think I told you guys the source of the form.
No.
Sorry. And that's another thing. It's found it in the computer. There is a sutra called the Four Dharmas. Chushibito. The Sutra of the Four Dharmas. And it actually explains the four forces. So I think there's some suspicion among certain Buddhist schools of the teaching of the four forces that you could actually lessen your karma or that you could affect your karma. And I think you know, you get the feeling from some schools that they say, oh, you know, the Buddha never said that or something like that. But I found the sutra. The sutra is there. It's very short. It's one page. He says, here's the four forces and this is how, this is what they'll do for you. And it talks about having a headache. And that's all there is. I mean, that the Buddha did state the four forces. It's not even something that the later commentators came up with. It is in the Kanga. You can read it there. So I thought that was very good to see that, to find that.
Right now.
All right. Sometimes in a debate, you just try to change the subject.
if he's a good opponent, he brings you back.
Okay, we're going to... The sutra at this point reaches a place where the Buddha says to the Buddha, what should we call this sutra? What is the name of the sutra? And the Buddha says... Say Sharabki.
Sharabki.
Parotichinpa.
Parotichinpa.
You know this word by now, I think. Parotichinpa means paramita. Paramita. And paramita means perfection, right? We talked about it. It's interesting to me that nowhere in the Diamond Cutter does the Buddha call this book the Diamond Cutter. The book, the word diamond is never mentioned in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. When the Subhuti asked the Buddha directly, what do you call this sutra? The Buddha only answers, this is the perfection of wisdom. Huh? To me, it's a very, very wonderful question. We'll never know. But someone drew the link, you know, between those two things. And someone gave it that name. You know, whether, I don't know who. There's no record that I'm aware of. You know, it's been called that since the first time a printed book was printed, because this was the first printed book. But I haven't seen it. I don't know. You know, it's very beautiful, very interesting. Someone understood the connection and gave it that name, or maybe the Buddha gave it that name, I don't know. So he answers only it's the perfection of wisdom. There's four different kinds of perfection of wisdom. We're going to go through the four. Chone Drapa Shudup starts to go through them and he says, it's a long story, I'll just go on. Sounds like somebody else. Okay. Maybe he was going to do it in the fourth year of his class. People have this thing about Buddha nature, Buddha seed, there's this innate Buddha in everybody, if they could just uncover it. There is something similar to that. This has no connection with that at all. Okay? Totally different. All right? And we'll study that other thing someday, and it's very beautiful, it's very interesting. It doesn't mean that, but it does mean something similar. What do you guess is natural perfection of wisdom? I'll give you the rationale for calling it the natural perfection of wisdom, and then you guess, okay? It's some object which, for time without beginning, has never inspired a bad thought in anyone who saw it directly.
No.
What?
It's the emptiness of everything.
It is emptiness. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's why it's called natural perfection of wisdom. We'll talk more about that. But it has never, to anyone who saw it directly, it has never inspired a bad thought in them. You can't say that about any other object. You can meet the Buddha himself. There are people who are bitterly jealous of the Buddha. There are people who tried to harm the Buddha while he was on this planet. Arhats have been killed all over the place. Bodhisattvas are beaten up and despised by... You know, there's only one object like that, where when you're looking at it directly, it can never contribute in any way to a bad thought. Or anything to do with bad thoughts. Interesting. So that's ultimate reality. They're all synonyms. Is it positive or negative? It's negative. It's an absence of something. Does it have a cause or it doesn't have a cause? No cause. Things that have causes fluctuate. They come into being, they grow, they slowly grow bigger, they fluctuate, and then they slowly die out. They die out in stages. Emptiness isn't like that. As soon as the wall is here, its emptiness is here. As soon as the wall is destroyed, its emptiness is gone. But the emptiness doesn't get bigger, 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 and then fluctuate, and then get smaller, 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 smaller. It's not that. It's not like other caused things. It doesn't fluctuate. So it's negative, it's uncaused, it's unchanging. The emptiness of the wall never changes. It's just the fact that it's not anything other than our projections. It's never more or less not our projections. Anything but our, not our projections. It's always just that. It never changes. It's never more or less nothing but our projections. Okay? Its quality never changes. It's consistent. It's unchanging. It's uncreated. It does come into existence. It does go out of existence. Intellectual would be something mental.
It's the books.
It's the books. Okay? It's the books. It's defined as any teaching, verbal or written, that unerringly presents the Mahayana path and its result. So does it have to be a sutra? Does it have to be spoken by the Buddha?
No.
So this is what they call the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Okay, and oftentimes people get confused. They mix up the Perfection of Wisdom, meaning those, that collection of literature, with the actual mental state of the Perfection of Wisdom.
So when you say it presents unerringly the Mahayana path and result, does it necessarily have to be about emptiness? It could be about anything.
There's no Buddhist... It's a long story. Normally, in a debate, you would say something like, all Buddhist books are talking about emptiness. Some are not talking about it directly. Something like that. Okay? Like the Abhisamayalankara. You know, it's a huge masterpiece. I mean, it's short, but the commentaries on it are tens of thousands of pages.
Well, for example, Refuge.
It doesn't treat emptiness directly.
Refuge, Bodhicitta, all those things are included in this?
Not necessarily. Yeah, you could say. Any book that teaches, say, refuge would be teaching the Mahayana path and its result. I don't know, could you say that? Yes, the Mahayana path and its result, right? If it mentions the results of, you know, normally when you have a teaching on refuge, it mentions the benefits of taking refuge, and that includes eventually vision, beautiful, and stuff like that. Does it have to teach the entire path? I don't think so.
Just the fact that it mentions Buddha, that implies it to get there.
We'll get there. That's coming tonight. Okay, so that's the textual perfection of wisdom. That's the books. Number three. A path perfection of wisdom is defined as the wisdom of a bodhisattva imbued with wisdom and method.
I'm sorry, imbued with what?
Wisdom and method. Wisdom and method, when they're presented that way as a pair, wisdom and method are a code word for what?
Emptiness and bliss. Emptiness and compassion.
What's? Are you mixing two?
Yes.
Code words for perception of emptiness, correct view, and what? What's method?
Bodhicitta.
Bodhicitta. Okay. Desire to reach Buddhahood so you can help other people. The definition of the path of perfection of wisdom is the wisdom of a bodhisattva, which is completely soaked in. The understanding of emptiness, and the wish to achieve Buddhahood so you can help other beings. In other words, compassion. Soaked in, the reason they have to say soaked in or imbued with is that when that bodhisattva is on the path of seeing, the first half of the path of seeing, can he have a manifest thought of bodhicitta? Cannot. Okay? Because that would be a conceptual thought. Can't have a conceptual thought while he's perceiving emptiness directly. So what? He's not a bodhisattva for that 5 minutes? You see? Does he lose bodhicitta for that 5 minutes? Because he's not having it directly. So they have to say imbued. Imbued means it's there, it's in his consciousness. Subconsciousness? It imbues his entire being, but it's not manifest at that moment. You can guess, who has resolved perfection with them?
Buddha.
That's a Buddha, okay? It's the omniscience of a Buddha. Now, question, if I say restrict yourself, well, no, that's going too far. Well, okay. Restrict yourself to the true meaning of the word perfection, which is what?
The Buddha.
Paramita. Gone to the other side, right? Gone to the other side. If I say restrict yourself to the strict sense of paramita, or perfection, which one of these is the perfection of wisdom?
Four.
Number four. Okay. So somebody asks you on your homework, which one is the real one? You know, and that's what I mean in that sense. if I say restrict yourself to the meaning of perfection in the sense of perfected, it has to be number four. Okay? But we all know and we all remember from that other class we had that what qualifies you as a paramita is what?
Dedication.
When it's dedicated to enlightenment, that's enough to call it paramita. That's why bodhisattvas can have what? Paramitas. They're not Buddhas. It's not perfected in their case. It's making them perfected. So it's enough that you can be called a perfection. You get the name perfection if you're just dedicated to Buddha. In with a real bodhicitta. Once it's that, it's a perfection. Should I say with real bodhicitta? Maybe not. You can practice in perfection before becoming a bodhisattva.
What do you mean, real bodhicitta?
There's two kinds of bodhicitta. There's sugarcane and real bodhicitta. Anyway, I would say probably you can practice perfection wisdom even before you have true bodhicitta. We can practice the perfections if we dedicate them to Buddha. But apparently it's the dedication. Which one is the Buddha talking about in this? When Subodhi asked the Buddha, what do I call this book? Which one is he talking about?
First.
Number two. It's the text. He says you can call this book the perfection of wisdom. It's a case of the book being named from its subject matter. The name of the book being given from its subject matter. It's like calling a book about automobile repair, or something like that. Okay? It's not automobile repair. It's a book about automobile repair, but you can call it automobile repair. Alright, so those are the four kinds of perfection of wisdoms. And then the Buddha says to Subodhi, does this perfection of wisdom exist? And Subodhi, being the smart guy that he is, since he's Manjushri, says what? No. And the Buddha says, and that's exactly why we can call it the perfection of wisdom. Okay? I'll run it by you again. Okay? The Buddha says to Subodhi, don't forget where he's coming from. In the sentence before, Subodhi asked the Buddha, what do we call this book? And the Buddha said, perfection of wisdom. And he says, well, Subodhi, do you think it exists? And Subodhi says, no. And the Buddha says, right, and that's why we can call it the perfection of wisdom.
And if there was another sentence, he could say, but can we really call it the perfection of wisdom? And he would have to say no.
Yeah, right, okay. That one sentence, that last exchange, where the Buddha says, does this perfection of existence exist, even exist? And Subodhi says, no. And the Buddha says, right, that's why we can call it the perfection of wisdom. In that one exchange is contained the whole meaning of Majjhimika. Okay? And now we're going to get into that. I missed something here. This one's positive or negative? It's an absence of something. Changing or unchanging?
Unchanging.
No. Created or uncreated?
Uncreated.
Uncreated. Okay. Perfectly constant in its quality or not? Does it ever vary?
No.
Okay. By the way, what causes variation is a flux in the cause. When the cause fluxes, the result fluxes. Right? That's important later. Is textual perfection wisdom, is it positive or negative?
Positive.
When the book is in your hand, right? You got it in your pink notebook there. That's a perfection, textual perfection wisdom. Changing or not?
Changing.
Created or not?
Created.
Created. Can it be destroyed?
Yes.
In which of the 500 years? Yeah, right. You know that, okay? Is it physical or mental?
Physical.
Physical. It's either of the nature of speech or the written word. It's either visual form or audible. Audible or visual. It's something you hear from a teacher or it's something you read in a book. And mainly Buddhism would say heard. Path perfection wisdom is mental or physical?
Physical.
You.
Mental.
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 Isn't it both?
No, it's the state of mind imbued with, it's the wisdom of a bodhisattva imbued with bodhicitta and knowledge of emptiness.
But doesn't your body change in the course of the path? Doesn't the matter change in the course of the
Your body changes in the course of the emptiness of the wall. It doesn't mean the emptiness of the wall is changing. Okay, path perfection of wisdom is mental. Okay, How about, and it's positive, and it changes, and it grows, and it dies away. Right? How about result perfect? How often does it die away? Yeah, like that. Santani, they call it. It peaks and dies out every second, every millisecond.
Why is that? Because your mind is changing?
Yeah, the cause changed. Result perfection of wisdom is positive or negative?
Positive.
Positive. Is it creative? We hope so. We're trying to do that, right? Can it die out?
Hopefully.
It does. No, the wisdom of Buddha, the omniscience of Buddha?
Everything.
No, of course. It is changing. It does die out moment for moment. Okay. Even the Buddha's wisdom dies out moment to moment. Okay. Will it, you know, ultimately die out? No. It doesn't have to be changing. It doesn't have to be called perishable. Because it's perishing by the instant. And something positive. And something mental. Okay? These are totally different, and don't get confused between them. The books are physical, the last two are mental. The first one is emptiness itself, not mental or physical. It's just an absence of something. It's a negative thing. A lot of people get them mixed up. If you remember those qualities, you won't get them mixed up. Okay, madhyamika. What does madhyam mean? By the way, ikka and akka, sometimes you see madhyamaka. They're all the same. They're just Sanskrit endings, generic endings. Madhyam is directly related to the English word what? Medium. Or middle. And you gotta see madhyamika like, I'm not a very good artist, as you know. You know, here's the goal, right? It's a cave on a mountain, right? and here's the winding path. Okay? And it goes along a cliffside, okay? On each side. It's supposed to be like that. Madhyam, middle path, middle way philosophy means it threads a path between two cliffs. And those two cliffs are called in Tibetan Ta. There's one over here, and there's one over here. You can't see it, right? It's what they call the two extremes. But the word Ta, extreme, is explained in all the scriptures, all the major scriptures, as referring to Taryang. Taryang means a cliff. And when you hear the word extreme now in Buddhism, you have to think of it that way. It's literally described in the scriptures, in the great scriptures, as a cliff. A cliff that's, you know, an abyss is on each side. You know, not just a ditch, okay? It's like, if you fall off that cliff, that's it. You know, it's thousands of feet down. That's what Ta means. Ta doesn't just mean extreme. It means, it's extremely literally drunk. Defined in the text as Jagyang. Jagyang means, Jag means a rock mountain crag, and Yang means an abyss, and it means a cliff, a cliffside. Okay? Edge of a cliff, you can say. How's that? Edge of a cliff. If you fall into either one, I mean a physical cliff like that, what happens? You die. The book doesn't only say die. The books don't only say die. They say pumargyur. Pumargyur is an unusual verb. And it means to waste something precious. It means a big waste, a great loss. It doesn't just say you lose your life or you lose your, you know, you suffer or something like that. It says you wait, you get wasted. You have a tremendous loss. So we have to describe madhyamika. This is madhyamika, right? And we have to describe those two, edge of the cliff, edges of the cliff, okay? Cliff edge, cliff, you call them. Anyway, edges of cliff, edge of the cliff. There's an edge of the cliff on this side, and there's an edge of the cliff on that side, and all the scriptures say the same thing. If you wander over here and go too far, it's worse than dying. Dying only screws you up for how many lives?
One.
Okay? Falling off this cliff screws you up for countless lives. You can screw up for many, many lives. Thousands of years of mess up, waste of time. So you have to know those two tas. You have to know them very, very well. You have to study them a lot. The first one is this, okay? Say yata.
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 Yata means what? Do you know, you guys know that? Most common verb in Tibetan language. Exists. Okay, exists. Yur means exists. Ta means that. You can call it extreme, and all the books will call it extreme, and it's not a bad translation, but think of it as a cliff. Cliff, edge of the cliff. And it's saying, if you go to 100 people standing in line at the Port Authority for a bus, and you say, you know, look around, does everything exist the way it looks to you? And they say, well, yeah. You want a nickel or something, or a quarter? What do you want? What's your problem, you know? Try a way to talk to you, I guess. But I mean, if you go up to 100 normal Joes, right, on the street, and you say, is all this stuff around you pretty much what it seems to you to be? Does it exist the way it seems to you? They'll say, well, sure. Okay? And that's the extreme of existence. It's called the extreme of existence.
Or common sense.
Well, we'll get there.
Does this also include the belief in a sort of eternal soul?
We'll talk about it. Then there's another extreme. Specifically when someone gets a bad teaching about what?
Emptiness.
Okay. It's a reaction to a bad teaching on emptiness. It's where the teacher says that nothing means anything, it's all an illusion, you're not seeing anything at all right, and it's invalid, and then the person swings, it's like a pendulum on a clock. He's been over here all this time, and then you let go, and it swings over to the other side. And he says, oh, then I can do whatever I want. And it's that famous story, I think we talked about it. Joanna Macy talks about it in one of her books. It's like, they went to a Buddhism conference at a hotel, and they're all walking home together to the lobby, and one girl's suitcase drops, and it breaks open, and all these hotel towels fall out. And the girl is all red, but she says, well, it's all empty anyway. It doesn't matter, does it? You know, I stole the towels from the hotel. You know, and that was her. That's classic metta. That's classic metta. You know, because the towels are empty, or because the towels don't exist the way I thought they did, well, then I can steal them. Then nothing really matters then. Things can be whatever I want. Human nature would love that to be true, right? You know?
This only exists in respect to the teachings on emptiness. It doesn't refer to like all the forms of nihilism that have...
No,
that have
that's why I don't like to translate it as nihilism. It doesn't refer to the classical French... I don't know how to pronounce his name. Sartre?
Well, or Dostoevsky or anybody.
You know, presentation of why nothing means anything. It's normally a classic reaction to some elementary or introductory teachings on emptiness or insufficient teachings on emptiness, and the person swings over to this. So how many people in the Port Authority in the line there, 100 people, how many people have metta?
None.
Extremely rare. You know, I mean, it might be one or two people out of the whole Port Authority at any given time, okay? Metta is a reaction. Metta is not very common. It takes intellect and bad Buddhist education to have metta, okay?
What is metta?
May means doesn't exist. So that's the extreme of thinking that things don't exist.
Could you have good Buddhist teaching and bad karma?
Sure.
To have this?
Sure. Okay. By the way, I have to clarify one thing very, very important. The ta is the reality or the truth of this statement. And this ta is the truth of this statement. Okay, the real ta is the truth of this statement, and the real ta here is the truth of this statement.
What do you say ta meant?
Cliff. I like to call it edge of a cliff, but you could call it. You could call it 1 inch past the edge of the cliff if you want.
I don't get what you mean. The cliff is the truth of the statement.
Well, I'll talk about it. Ta is the truth of this statement. Yuta is the truth of this statement. Now, here's the punchline for Mr. Stillwell. Is this statement true?
No.
No. It's not true at all. Yuta doesn't even exist. The extreme viewpoint that everything exists the way you think it exists is a falsity.
It's a deceptive truth.
The object of the viewpoint, what the viewpoint is focused on, doesn't exist. Does the viewpoint itself exist? Does the belief exist?
Yes.
Yeah. That's why we distinguish between the ta and the tanzin. Yeah, tanzin. not like Tarzan, but it's close. Tarzan is the wrong belief in this crazy idea. The Ta is the crazy idea. Or the object of the crazy idea. It doesn't even exist. The fact that things look the way they are the way they look doesn't even exist. Right? It's not true. It's like saying the sky is green. The sky is green doesn't even exist. Believing that the sky is green exists or not?
Yeah. The colorblind people.
You can be crazy. You know, you can be drugged out wearing green sunglasses. You go, oh man, the sky is. Traffic lights turn blue on. So it's important to understand that the Ta, the object of the belief, things existing the way they look, doesn't even exist. Things don't exist the way they look. It's a little subtle. The object of the belief doesn't even exist. It's like a self-existent person. It's like a guy at work who is a bad guy from his own side. Does that exist? No. Does anybody hold to that? We all do. I mean, after all these teachings, I had somebody come up to me and start telling me how bad their boss was. You know, I said, oh, man. And I was agreeing for a while. I was like, yeah, I had the same problem. This is really bad. But I caught myself. You know, I just bad-talked the person. That's going to perpetuate him. You know. The guy at work that is really bad from his own side, the way he looks to be bad, is tough. It doesn't exist. It's the purple elephant. And holding to it or believing to it, oh, definitely that exists. Even bugs have it. Bugs have yud tan zin. Bugs have it. Bugs believe that what they see is correct. What about... Then you have to say tan zin over here too. Okay. This is a med tan zin. You hold to that. But it's interesting to note that the thing doesn't even exist. I mean, Buddhism isn't trying to get you to recognize some new thing. It's just trying to get you to see that what you always thought wasn't even there. It's not that you have to imagine that the thing's not there. You just have to recognize that it was never there in the first place. It's a lot easier. And Majjhimika means spreading out through those two. Going out through those two.
What you just said about
this one. It's just the opposite. It's to hold. It's the belief in the truth of this thing. But this truth, this statement is false. This statement is false. This doesn't exist. It's not true that if things weren't the way you always thought they were, that they couldn't exist at all. It's not true to say that if the towels are just your projection, you can steal them with impunity. It's not true. That's a falsity. That's metta. To believe that is metanzin. Mepetanzin. The object of that belief doesn't even exist. That lady was having an hallucination in a sense. It's just a falsity. It doesn't exist. The fact that you can steal towels if they're empty is totally wrong. There's no such object. And then Madhyamika goes up to the middle of that. Now, a question that Robin asked, there are two brothers of these two. This is, you know, I don't want to confuse you or overload you, but this is, it's also called Dakta. Ta is the same, right? Means what? 1 inch past the edge of the cliff, okay? I don't know what you want to call it.
Over the cliff.
We'll call it extreme, okay?
Over the edge.
Dak, yeah, over the edge is pretty good. Dak means permanent. It's Dakpa, permanent. It's the extreme of thinking that things could last forever. It's what they call in the books on Buddhism, it's what they translate eternalism. But I'll explain it. I'll explain in a minute and you'll catch it, okay? If the guy at work that is bad to you ever becomes your friend, if he ever changes into your friend, what really changed?
Your
projections. Okay? Your projections. Which are forced on you by your
karma.
So what really shifted was your
karma.
Karma. Your karma wore out. It stopped forcing you to have that projection. And the guy seemed to get nice. Did he get nice on his own? Did he get nice from his side?
No.
Did he change?
No.
Your projection shifted. If you want to get rid of bad guys, What should you do? Stop collecting the causes from those lousy projections. Shift your karma. And the tight-fisted boss you had will become generous. And the asshole at work will become your best friend. And 39th Street will open a pizza parlor.
Just for you.
It's a shift, you know. It's a shift in your projections. Truly, truly it is. That's key to getting enlightened. That's key to practicing Tantra, obviously. That's key. Very, very important. That's the whole... If you know that, everything's possible. If you don't know that, nothing's possible. If he changed from his own side, if you're going to sit around and wait for him to change from his own side, you'll sit around for eternity. Takta. That's the implication of holding yitta. If you're going to believe in this, if you're going to believe that he's bad from his side, you're going to wait around forever for him to change. He can't change. That's eternalism. That's the real meaning of eternalism in Buddhism. You know, and I think when you read the book, sometimes it's very unclear. That's not clear. The point is, if you believe in yitta, if you believe that he exists the way he looks, that he's bad from his side, then his badness, his evilness has to be permanent. He'll always be bad. He'll never die. He'll never get a little nicer. He'll never get worse. He'll always be just the same. Because it's not dependent on you. It's not dependent on your projections. Then he's going to be that way forever. He'll never change. Because something will never shift. What? Your projections, okay? If he doesn't depend on your projections, he's going to be that way forever. That's a necessary consequence of believing yata. Okay, so tata is a derivative of yata. Yeah.
So then what's the difference between sitting around waiting for him to change versus sitting around and waiting for your karma that you're experiencing to change?
Same thing. Same thing.
So then you can't do anything about it then, in either case, right?
Well, that's what we talked about, purification. You can speed it up. Cause him to change. You're saying you have to sit around and wait for your karma to ripen? That's why we went over the four forces. It's exactly why we went over the four forces.
No, if you have no choice, it's forced upon you because of your karma.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah. Collect some good karma and it'll be
forced. If you don't have a choice, then you do have a choice. If you do have a choice to affect the karma that's coming your way, then you actually do have a choice that you're not using if you're sitting
right
waiting for your karma to change.
That's true.
And it's sometimes, if you do sit around and wait for it to change, it'll change anyway, maybe. Or
what do you mean when you say anyway? Without karma shifting? Is that what you
mean?
Well,
I mean, there's... I didn't particularly work on any karma sometimes for a situation to change, and it changed.
Hell beings can become humans. That's why animals can become humans. It's not by any great... The trick of getting out of an animal realm is real difficult. You just have to wait it out, you know. Unless you do some accidental good karma, you just got to wait it out.
So actually, you can't take control of the process then.
No, a human being can with wisdom, but not an animal or a hell being. They just got to wait it out until the projection shifts, and those projections take millions of years. Time slows down in hell. Part of the projection.
Speed up my path.
Well, of course, it's his projection.
Speeding up the path.
Maybe.
Excuse me?
I said, if his projection shifts, it may change something also.
Not for him,
yeah,
not for you.
I do.
It may change it for you also.
No.
Because the way you
never,
say
ever.
It, there can be no
never,
such
ever.
Thing as collective karma.
Collective experience of collective karma, yes.
No, because there would be nobody else out there. If it's all a projection... You're a projection, everybody else here is a projection. There's really not, I mean, you get down to this, there's nothing out there. There's nothing here.
Because it's a projection, there is not nothing out there. It's hot. You'll get into that. I don't like to hear, even though things are empty, they still exist. Or even though things are empty, I still have to be good. That's a wimpy Buddhist statement. That's a semi-educated Buddhist statement. The real one is, because they're empty, I have to be good. Because things are empty, I must be moral. It's not that even though things are empty, we still have to be moral. That's an immature Buddhist statement. The real mature Buddhist statement is, we'll break there. In your notebooks, in your reading this time, that's taken from Tsongkhapa and Pobongkhana. And it's a line, It's part of a verse by Tsongkhapa where he explains how to get rid of the two Tarnzins. Okay? How to get rid of those two wrong ideas. And he's describing the highest school of Buddhism, how they describe how to get rid of those two. It's not the same in the lower schools. And you can read about it in your reading. Basically, he says if you want to get rid of Yata, which is which one? What's Yata say to itself? Your Tarnzin, actually.
Self-existence.
Things are the way it looks.
Yeah, everything is just the way it seems to me. Okay? That's eliminated. Cell means eliminated or cleared away. Cell is what a light does to darkness in a room. When you flip on the switch, cell is the verb for what the light does to the darkness. Dispels it. What dispels the belief that everything is just the way you think it looks is nawa. Nawa means understanding dependent origination. Understanding how projections work perfectly. When does that happen? When do you directly understand that? When do you perfectly understand that?
The moment before you start?
Yeah, the moment before. That supreme dharma, supreme phenomenon, they call it the last moments of the path of preparation, before you see emptiness directly, you understand something very important about Chi Che Dang, right? About
everything you see as a fault.
Yeah, that you understand standing looking at the stove and realizing that you're not looking at a pot, you're looking at your impression of a pot. You're looking at your idealization of a pot. You're looking at something in your own mind. So this happens before what? Before you see emptiness directly. What Tsongkhapa is saying and what the highest school of Buddhism says, Manimika Prasangika, Nagarjuna's school, Tsongkhapa's school, it says you can get rid of thinking things look the way that you thought they did. You can get rid of thinking that things are the way they look to you if you understand how you're doing your projections. If you understand the process of those mental pictures, that will remove the tendency to think that things what? Are the way they look to you. That makes sense, right?
Say it again.
When you understand that everything is just your mental images or your projections, then you're not going to have a problem anymore of thinking that things are the way they look to you. Sure, the pot looks like it's outside there on the stove, but especially at the last moments of the path of preparation. And as I look at it and understand I'm just looking at an idealized pot in my own mind based on certain data that I get from around the stove, then I'll never again believe that things are just the way they seem to me. That's very profound. You have to cook that. It's very profound.
Okay.
And then, Tongba means what, you know? Tongba means emptiness. Tongbei means the understanding of emptiness does something. Does what? Cell means dispels, clears away like a light clears away darkness. Metta. Metta means believing that nothing exists or that nothing matters. And it's what I said before. Because things are empty, everything what? Does exist. Because things are empty, everything does matter. Because things are empty, they can change. Because things are empty, you can see yourself become a Buddha. Because things are empty, they can become paradise. So if someone comes up to you and says, because things are empty, nothing exists, it's totally wrong. Totally the opposite. He's saying, because things are empty, you won't get the idea that nothing exists anymore. When you understand emptiness, you won't think that nothing matters anymore. When you understand emptiness, you will know why you have to be moral. So those are two lines from Tsongkhapa. That's Tsongkhapa's crowning achievement. That line there. It's beautiful. When Trijang Rinpoche wrote Rinpoche's Long Life Prayer, at the end, he says, Nang Tong Gyame Chuying Tenda To. He does an act of truth. You know what an act of truth is? It's a Sanskrit concept. It's an Indian concept. Do you know what act of truth is?
No.
It means you stand at the Ganges River and you say, if it's true, I never had a jealous thought in my whole life. May the Ganges River flow upstream. And you know, and it's called an act of truth. The Buddha did them from time to time. You know, his brother was very ill, the half-brother who hated him, who was jealous of him. Actually, the Buddha took some medicine. And he took, like, one pill of medicine. Was he really sick? No, he was pretending, okay? And his jealous half-brother, when he got sick, said, I'm going to take twice as many pills as the Buddha took. And the Buddha said, don't take this medicine. It's too powerful for you. I can take any medicine you can take. So he took the medicine, and he got really sick. He got almost died. So the Buddha did an act of truth. He went to the bedside. He put his hand on his half-brother's head, you know, on his forehead. He said, if it's true, I never had a bad thought in my whole life. May you be cured at this moment. And the guy's eyes open, and he sees the Buddha, and he knocks his hand off his head. Get your hand off my head. So it was an act of truth. He was cured, at least in the physical illness. Right? It's called an act of truth. So Nang Tong Gyal Me Chu Yin Ten Dab Tob, Chijang Rinpoche, at the end of Rinpoche's long life prayer, does an act of truth. And he says, if what I'm about to say is true, may you live forever. Who? Ken Rinpoche. Yeah, because he wrote his long life prayer. So he says, Nang Tong Gyal Me means, Nang Tong Gyal Me, which means, if dependent origination, if the fact that you are projecting everything and the fact of emptiness are perfectly compatible, if every object must have both, then if that's a true statement, then you should never die. It's beautiful. That's the ultimate compliment of a Buddhist master, another Buddhist master. If it's true that everything is a projection, and if it's equally true that everything is empty, and if those two truths complement each other, if I speak true at this moment, may you never die. It's really beautiful. The verse is really beautiful. It's an act of truth. It's a true statement. Anyway. So you see great Buddhist philosophers throughout history saying the same thing. Nagarjuna said it. Tsongkhapa said it. Trishan Rinpoche said it. Prabhupada said it. Okay, last thing. Since certain buses are leaving for Queens, say there's four great facts. Four great facts exist. They consist of two don't exists and two do exists. I guess I should say do exists. These are the two don't exists, okay? And it means this. Rangshinki, say Rangshinki.
Rangshinki.
Rangshinki means naturally. Me means here, nothing exists. So what does that mean? Nothing exists
naturally.
Okay. Nothing exists from its own side. Jiang, but. We have to skip to Mayin, okay? Tibetan sentence structure is the opposite. Mayin means, it's not that. Here the Mepa means, nothing exists. Mepa means, nothing exists. Dene means, at all. So what's it say?
Nothing exists from its own side, but it's not true that nothing exists at all.
Nice. Okay? Nothing exists naturally. But that doesn't mean that nothing exists at all. How many nothing exists we got here?
Two.
Those are the two nothing. Those are the two don't exist. Okay. All right. If you understand these four, you'll never. Babonka says it directly at the end of the reading. He says, if you can avoid those two extremes, you'll never screw up your Buddhism. You will never make any major blunders in your Buddhist practice. If you avoid those two extremes, you're going to be all right. He states that. This one?
Yeah, nothing exists naturally.
Nothing exists naturally, meaning from its own side. But it's not that nothing exists at all. That would be Mepe Tanzin. That would be holding that nothing exists because it doesn't exist the way you thought it did. Cheryl, if you gotta go. Because the punchline is you can call anybody you get there. And that's the last thing. Tani Tsamdu means in name only. Tani Tsamdu means in name only. By the way, in Buddhism, that means in projection only. Name means an idea in Buddhism. You have to remember that. It's not that just things are just little words taped on things, obviously. In name only in Buddhism means in thought only, in idealization only, in projection only. You have to remember that. Tanya, in name only, ye means everything exists. So that means so far,
Everything does exist in name only, meaning in our projections only. Counting you had above, what did it mean? But, okay, counting means but. Now we have to skip to the back because the Tibetan sentence only. Mayan means what? Same thing.
It's not that.
Mayan means it's not that. Yopa means everything exists. Rangshingi means naturally. If you understand these four elements, by the way, I'll state this one again. You can say it this way. It's true that everything exists in name only, only through your projections. But that doesn't mean that everything exists naturally. If you can draw those four distinctions, you will never fall off the cliff. And that cliff's a hell of a lot bigger than any cliff on Earth. Okay? That cliff is deadly. That cliff is fatal. Most of the mass of humanity will fall off that cliff in this life and die and go to someplace bad. You know, that's, they will fall off that cliff. Majjhimika is very narrow way, right? Not many people on that road. Okay? So, the distinction is this. It's true that nothing exists the way it seems, but it doesn't mean that nothing exists at all. It's true that everything is just a projection, and that it works, but that doesn't mean it exists the way you thought it did. Okay? You have to be able to make those distinctions. You have to be able to make those four distinctions. If you figure that out at home, those four, you understood the two tasks, and you will never leave the Majjhimika. Then you're a real Majjhimika. That's all it takes.
Could you do those two sentences one more time?
Yeah. It's true that nothing exists naturally, but that doesn't mean that nothing exists at all. It's true that nominally everything exists, but that doesn't mean that everything exists naturally. If you understand those four, you'll never fall off the cliff. You'll be on Majjhimika. You'll reach that little cave up there on the mountain.
Okay, Sukhsin Veto Cha Viravin Chini De Gyanpa Vi Sanye Sindhu Mite Hoa Vi Prakun Nam Dag Sinla Chupa Sonam yeshe le jungwe, tampa kuni topa.